Hey, Talkhouse listeners, it's Josh Modell. Instead of encouraging you to listen to podcasts today, I'm here to encourage you to read something great. The particular something I have in mind is the second issue of the Talkhouse Reader, the print zine spearheaded by our fantastic music editor, Annie Fell. This issue is focused on the intersection of food and music, and it features contributions from Maddie Matheson, Coleman Domingo, Squirrelflower, Sam Evian, The Blessed Madonna, and more. There are pieces about eating while on tour, the gentrification of food, cooking as a creative catalyst, and much, much more. You can order a copy today, along with the first issue, at store.talkhouse.com. Please do check it out.
What's up? This is Ellie Einhorn. Welcome back to the Talkhouse Podcast. Today I'm joined by
Nick Dawson, editor-in-chief of Talkhouse Film. It is good to see you.
It's good to see you. I haven't seen you since the football.
Since the football, England, geographically connected to the country of my birth, eventually through great hardship beating Colombia.
That was a hell of a game.
Did you see that tweet? Somebody was like, I can't believe we got beaten by a nation that eats
beans on toast.
Yeah.
Oh, I saw it. And I'll be seeing it all the way to the game next Saturday.
But you know what? We don't have beans on toast, but we have boots on toast.
Wow. Okay. Well, that perfectly brings us to our show today. Another fantastic Talkhouse conversation between filmmaker Ronaldo Marcus Green and the one and only Boots Riley.
The man wears a hat like nobody else.
Hey, he's going full Pharrell on this one.
Stylish hat wearer. You will see that on the Talkhouse website. You'll see that on Instagram. Go check it out. Dude's got hats for days.
He's also got a new movie for days, and this is blowing the fuck up.
Yeah, Sorry to Bother You is a big, big deal. We were very lucky to get in on the ground floor. I recorded this conversation at the Sundance Film Festival in a hotel lobby with some nice music in the background. But yeah, this is me.
I thought it was a nice accompaniment.
I tried to get the music turned off, but the fact that they started it halfway through the conversation, you know, a little bit tough. But it was a great conversation. Two guys who knew each other kind of from the Sundance system. Ray went through the labs, so did Boots. Ray had short films there. Boots went there. Well, we'll hear that whole story, but he took an unconventional route.
He did. Now, many of our listeners here at Talkhouse, and most people in general, are going to know Boots Riley as the leader of the coup. Not necessarily as a filmmaker, but as a rapper. And I mean, this is a guy who's put out tracks with titles like The Guillotine and My Favorite Mutiny. Boots is a very, very political lyricist.
Yeah. Both these guys, in very different ways, are incredibly political filmmakers. Sorry to Bother You is this like wild satire about race, about society, about the modern world, really, about the way we live our lives. And Monsters and Men, Ray's movie, is a very serious film about race and the relationship between the police and the black community. And both of them take their conversations to new and exciting and challenging places.
Nick, it's July 5th as we're recording this intro, and it has been really exciting to watch Sorry to Bother You just garner more and more and more hype before it drops this week. I'm also really looking forward to Monsters and Men coming out this October.
Yeah, both these guys are really here to stay. Super impressive films, very different films. I'm very excited for what they have. Of course, we know, like, as of just like a week or two ago, Ray is now going to be directing The Big Blow, which is a movie about the legendary boxer Jack Johnson, which will be produced by none other than
Ridley motherfucking Scott.
Yep, we're definitely going to be seeing a lot more of him.
Very exciting stuff. Now, Boots and Ray chop it up about a lot of things. We hear about the very different journeys to get each of these films made.
Yeah, Boots had a long and unconventional journey, and
which included, parenthetically, Dave Eggers and an LP.
Yeah, yeah. Not the artist LP, but an LP, a long playing record. and Ray, well, he'll tell us all about it, but his was much shorter but still very challenging.
They also get into the financial realities of being an indie filmmaker in 2018.
Yeah, the word broke comes up quite a bit.
It sure does on both sides.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we also hear about partying with Idris Elba.
And, you know, Ray talks about a potential dream project I'm not going to ruin it, but let's just say 007 in the house. Hopefully. Hopefully.
I also love the story about Boots trying and failing to illegally download Final Draft.
He's a good guy. He plays by the rules.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah. And of course, like on the subject of the internet, you know, the problems that the internet and social media and how that gets in the way of creativity. It's a recurrent theme on these podcasts that we record.
Well, Nick, today's conversation kicks off with a topic that I feel like almost anybody who's been to Sundance can speak to.
Completely. Going there and the stress of trying to find a distributor, of trying to get your movie sold. These guys did to big distributors. It's a success story, but it's still a very tense time.
Should we roll it?
Let's roll the tape.
Here's Ray Green kicking things off.
I was a little stressed, I'm not going to lie. You know, just coming to the festival, and of course, you just want to enjoy it. You're a filmmaker, you're here at Sundance, and I just couldn't relax like the first few days. And I was like, wait,
this
is crazy.
I tried to get drunk, but it hit me the wrong way. Because I was like, oh, yeah, cool, fuck, maybe I drink. And it just got me more.
Yeah, no.
I'm calling up Mark Anglin, the sales agent, at 3 in the morning, like, stressed out and drunk.
Yeah.
I do more.
Yeah, so I just couldn't let go. It's funny because we premiered at Eccles on Friday. And you hear stories about filmmakers selling their movie, you know, distributors leaving the theater and, like, you know, getting deals. And then it was quiet, you know, it's a little quiet. And I don't know if, like, they were getting calls and, you know, other people were circling. I don't know. They didn't tell me the details of how all the distributors kind of, you know, which distributors were interested. So I don't really know the details of that. But we had a party Friday night and, like, Idris Elba was at our party dancing. And I was like, yeah, that's cool, man. I was just like, yeah, give me some water. You know, it was like, man, I was dancing at my party and my wife was like, she was like, I'm going in back. I don't know about you. And it was hilarious because I just couldn't relax, man. It was just like, man, I don't know if it's just like the pressure of like my first film. I don't know, film.
It's hard because, I mean, you can't do anything to change what people are going to think about it. Like with me, since, you know, I'm a performer, like, if I'm in front of a crowd, I can, like, okay, they seem to respond to this instead of that. We're going to do more of this right now. And then, okay, we're cutting this song right here. We're going to that other song we usually don't play. We're doing that, you know, or whatever. Okay, we got to get more hype. Fuck it, I'm going to do a flip, you know, something like getting them, but. With the film, you're just sitting there. There's nothing you can do. You can't change this edit. Like, okay, let me get this, you know. And so I was physically, like, tense. And, you know, my girlfriend tried to grab my hand. I snatched it away.
It's hilarious. Like, no, it's true. Like, don't touch me. Don't touch me. It's cool.
So, yeah, that was pretty crazy right there. Yeah,
that would be amazing. I mean, I was you know, to think about ways to even take the film audience response one step further. If there was a way to, like, have smell come into the audience, or, like, you know, you have the scene with the grass and, like, you smell the dirt, or you smell the pine tar on the bat or whatever it is, like, to bring you, like, one step closer. Or I know they do, like, you know, sometimes you can get composers to, you know, to do live composition with the film. I mean, I think that would be such an amazing experience to sort of, like, really, really place you. You know, not having seen your film, do you think that's something that...
Well, so in the movie, I did the soundtrack, which is just all the diegetic stuff. So me and my band, The Coup, we did that. But the score is done by Toon Yards. And that would be amazing. So I mean, it wouldn't be fun for me to, I wouldn't want to, you know, because our stuff has words in it. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't, you know, that was something we dealt with. Like, now, a lot of times we used to get stuff placed in movies. And I'd be like, why are they going to use it if they're going to make it where you can't really hear what I'm saying, you know? And then I realized, oh, because it can get distracting and stuff. So I wouldn't do a live situation like that with The Coup doing the songs over the movie, because then you wouldn't see the movie. But it would be cool for the Toon Yard stuff, because her stuff is vocals, but no lyrics.
That would be amazing.
And so yeah, they could do that. That would be cool. But might be interesting for somebody to make a movie where you had, like, the controls of the edit, like, right there. Like, maybe you had three people at a board and, like, somebody being like, okay, the scene isn't working. Get to the next one. You know,
like, it's oversaturated. You know,
yeah, yeah. Turn up the reds
out,
and that
fade out in the middle of the scene. Just like <what? laughs> fast forward. Yeah, you
turn
know?
Turn up the reds and that.
Yeah, okay, time lapse. We need this is going. It's playing slow right now. Yeah, just let me just get to the end.
Yeah,
that's
go hilarious. To that second take instead.
That's funny. So can you just talk about like the timeline about you know like
yeah. How,
yeah, I know. I've heard
it's
stories.
Been a while.
About,
yeah. I started. Let's see. I downloaded Final Draft in 2011.
Legally or?
Well, I tried to do it illegally, but it's harder to do. Like, you need all kinds of codes and all that kind of stuff, and then you don't want to start writing something, and then it doesn't. Yeah. All then you lose those pages. So, you know, that's the reason why I did it legally. That first scene in the movie is the first scene I ever wrote. And, I finished it in 2012, but had no connection to anyone in the industry. The only people I knew, I'd done a show with David Cross. And somebody told me that Brian Posehn and Patton Oswalt were fans. So I was like, okay. You know, just kind of thinking about it in strategic way. So, but still, I didn't know anything. I got it to David Cross first. He said he had planned to not actually read it, but his assistant was house sitting the day that the package came because he had said he wanted it, the real paper. So she read it and then was like, you got to read this. So really lucky that she was there because then I was able to put his name. You know, he was like, yeah, just use this is actually hilarious. Use my name. You know, because being a musician, I might have more contacts. You know, for instance, I knew Danny Glover, but he was just like, you're this dude. You're my friend's son. Yeah, like. You're not a filmmaker or whatever. I mean, he never said that, yeah. But I know that's the, where, you know. And so energy, yeah. With if you do music, people are like, yeah, okay, you're a rapper. Of course you want to do a movie. You also want to start a Waffle House and you want to build a skyscraper,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, you're not, they more think it's probably not good, you know. So it was harder to get people to actually read it. But then David Cross, being like, David Cross is down. People are like, really? Okay. And because David Cross is not the first person you think of as just being a fan of the coup. Whereas, you know, just that's how maybe racism works. Like, if I had been like, oh, Mahershala Ali likes it, people would be like, oh, yeah, okay. He's an actor. He's from Oakland. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Like, yeah, he's just down with you, you know?
Yeah.
And so it made people open it. But in the meantime, I was broke and I had started doing, I'd made an album that was supposed to go along with the script, even though I didn't know. I thought maybe I wasn't going to be able to get it made and I'd just put the script out and that would be like complimenting that original album. And went for a couple years, ran into Dave Eggers in the street, just on the street in San Francisco. Well, he was with my boy J. Otto Siebold, who did all the, if people see the movie, he did all the titles and a lot of the fonts. Like for production design, we replaced the fonts on, so that's how weird we were getting on like signs, you know? Yeah. I said, hey, I might put this script out on the internet. Could you read this and just give me some notes? Because I want it to be the you know, in my mind, I was like, it's going to be on historical record that I wrote this script, you know, because I spent so much time on it. I want people to just know. And for me, people reading the script, the way I wrote it, with the descriptions, I wrote it so that they felt like they were watching it. And, like, I had jokes in the descriptions, like, there's a scene where Tessa's character is twirling a sign for a sign store. So her sign says signs. Yeah. And you know, and the store says signs. And so in the description, I said, apparently they're selling signs. So like I had extra lines all throughout my script that eventually I had to take down when it was like, how do we get this script shorter? I was like, okay, I know how to do it. You know, but it helped with people reading the script.
Because they felt immersed in that.
Anyway, so yeah, Dave Reggers read it. He was like, hey, you got to let me help you with this. And he put it out as his own paperback book in 2014. You know, I actually think that a lot of people read McSweeney's. The paperback book was packaged with the quarterly. So I've seen things come out since then that where I was like, oh, this person, they read my script.
Yeah.
That was the danger of it. But without doing that, I don't think I would have generated the, like, because once I was able to say it was published on McSweeney's, then that gave it even another level besides David Cross. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, somebody who's considered a great writer is co-signing you, you know, and came here to the Sundance Festival with books in hand, meeting people on the bus, trying to sneak into parties, meet people, you know, all that kind of stuff. And with the imprint I left from that, I applied to the Writers Lab, got in. Next year did the Directors Lab. Sundance brought us through Catalyst as well in between those two. And we met all the funders that funded the movie through that.
Through Catalyst. It's great.
Yeah. Then going through the labs also obviously added a certain amount of
legitimacy to the project.
You know, so when you're raising funds, when you're talking to actors, things like that. But yeah, I had to go around. Initially, I had to go around agencies to get to the actors.
Yeah.
Before, like, so for instance, I had written a letter to Tessa a year before that I didn't get an answer from. Mm. And then later, you know, her management was like, hey, we found this letter you wrote to Tessa. Does she have the part? You know, like, and so when I finally saw her do the chemistry read, I knew, like, this, she was Detroit. Wow. And anyway, so yeah, it was pretty long, drawn out situation altogether. 7 years from the time that I decided I was going to write the script.
Wow.
To now. But, you know, some of those years were spent promoting and trying to make money off an album and touring and stuff like that. So.
It's great. Yeah.
How about you?
We had a very fast sort of accelerated timeline. We had a short film called Stop in 2015. Which, you know, I was not thinking about making into a feature, but somehow, you know, with one of the actors who was a cop in the film, I got into a, you know, we started talking about, you know, the Eric Garner case in Staten Island, just from being from Staten Island. One thing led to another, and we got into a pretty heated discussion. And that conversation, like, stayed with me for like 6 months. So at that point, I was like, oh, okay. This is, you know, this was a world that I thought I could continue. I just didn't know how to stay in the world. You know, the short worked at 9 minutes. So why should I stretch it out and make it, you know, 90 minutes? I didn't see a world where that existed. And then when this conversation happened to me, I thought, okay, this is really interesting. This perspective is pretty interesting. And we hadn't seen it. At least I hadn't seen it. And that's how, like, the triptych structure was born. But yeah, so I wrote the script. About 6 months after June or something like that of 2015. And that little short film.
You work fast.
No, it was crazy. It was crazy. I mean, I had to, because my wife was about to say, you know, if this ain't gonna work, you know, we gotta find a way. And I was like, boo, just hold on. I was still in film school. So, you know, that was my third year film, that little short film. And that short played everywhere. Like, I made it for $500 and it played like in places that I would never ever would have imagined that people responded to it, like Deep South and Iceland and Australia. And I was like, wait, this is like, what, you know, it's a young black man getting stopped by the police. Like, why are people, you know, asking for my short film? So yeah. I knew that there was an audience for it. You know, but then of course there were films that were kind of, you know, similar or similar worlds. And I was like, I don't want it to be like anything else. I don't want it to be like Crash. I don't want it to be like Fruitvale Station. Those are movies that were great, got their acclaim, have been done. How do I make it different in a way that, you know, is mine and can add to the conversation rather than just like, okay, this is another movie that we've seen before. And so I think the approach, the triptych approach was one way that we, you know, kind of were able to bring out the perspective and kind of do that. And that first year we basically spent developing the script. I met my creative producers, Elizabeth Lodge and Josh Penn from the Department of Motion Pictures. And they had done this little movie called Beasts of a Southern Wild, which mm-hmm. just got out there in like a huge way. I remember that movie and I remember saying like, who are these, like New Orleans, like how did they, you know, and that movie went everywhere. I went to Sundance, went to Cannes, played. And I was just very impressed with how they took a little film and were able to like, really, I mean, they took it all the way to the White House. They took it to the Oscars. And I thought, you know, they complimented me and my style. I think they seemed like genuine people. And of course, you know, you hear different things about, oh, they don't, you know, it's a production company with money or no money. And they were a production company that didn't have any financing. So they were just truly creative producers in that sense. And they helped me to get into sort of like the institutional programs. So we got a Spike Lee Fund and CineReach and Tribeca and San Francisco Film Society, but they really helped like with the application and getting it out there and kind of like the real grassroots campaign. So we cobbled up enough money, maybe 50 or 60,000 in the year and a half, just trying to get, you know, little bits to put together, you know, enough of a package. And then once we had that package, my agent came on. And once I got an agent, Craig Castell, WME, he, like, honestly, the acceleration process just, I met Craig a year ago today, like, you know, this week. Like, he was at Sundance last year is when he became my agent. And the second that happened, all of a sudden, the same folks we were already talking to, or had seen and knew about the project, all of a sudden started paying attention, you know, kind of like, oh, okay, like, we're like, we just met you, you know, you know, it was like, it was sort of interesting once somebody of a certain caliber validates your project, all of a sudden the ears listen a little closer. And
you know, some of that makes sense in the sense that there's millions of things out there. Yeah. So you got to figure out what to spend your time reading.
100%. You know? 100%. And then that was it. We sat down with our investors, the folks sight unseen who ended up coming on and doing the project and at Tribeca this year. And so we took the project to the director's lab this summer in June. And the day I got back from the lab, we started prep. And we shot in September. We finished, last day was September 24th. And then it was basically a race. Wow. I mean, literally, like
I
you
wish
said,
I could work as fast as you.
No. Like, it's not recommended. You know what I mean? It's not recommended. I have some extra pounds that definitely got put on in the last few months and lost a few more hair follicles. But I mean, it needed to happen for this kind of film. I truly felt this way. You know, you meet all these investors, you meet all these people, they're like, yeah, we're gonna do it. And it falls apart. And I just had this weird feeling of like, if we don't hit this window right now, that like, yeah, we'll do it in the spring, like something by spring, anything could happen. And other movies that are kind of like it are tackling it, and then the movie just wouldn't happen. And so I was like, I think with an open door, we got to sprint through this thing right now. And that's kind of was the approach I, you know, was able to convince them that we had a real shot at getting into Sundance this year. It wasn't contingent upon it, but it was like, you know, this is a great platform for this kind of film. I mean, where else do you really take it in terms of getting a sale? You know, it's hard. Yeah. Like, there are amazing festivals in the world, like Tribeca and South By, and like, those are amazing festivals, but not that many films get bought out of those festivals. So in terms of like being able to get a sale for this kind of content, I thought Sundance was the best platform for it. So
yeah, that's beautiful that was able to happen. You know, we finished our movie at the end of July, July 29th or something like that. And then, so I've been in post since then until like a week and a half before this. But some of that was, you know, I had to make the soundtrack. I had made these things beforehand, but then after actually seeing what we shot, I was like, okay, that feeling is not... So we made this stuff, but also, you know, I'm slow at writing lyrics. And I was like, fuck, I got to write 14 songs while spending 10 hours a day editing first. Jeez. And then do it. So by about October, I was like, because we had to turn in everything for the sound mixing, like at the beginning of December. And I was like, okay, it's not going to happen. Not going to do. So I was like, okay, this first song, how many minutes does it, how many seconds does it have to be in there? 28 seconds. Okay, I'm about to write 28 seconds of lyrics that go right here. So right now, the soundtrack still has to, I have to go back and expand all the songs
or
whatever.
Crazy. So you were just...
Yeah, I was like, okay, exactly what is it? Because, you know, like, for me, like, I do, I writing lyrics, I go sit someplace, I throw my phone somewhere so that, because what'll happen is if I got my phone, I'm like checking shit, you know, like, what did anybody say anything about the movie? Yeah. Oh, what are people talking? Oh, people saying I don't hang out with them anymore. Okay, man, I'm about to hit you. I'm doing this, you know, all that type of shit. Yeah. And just any like little thing that takes me another 20 minutes to get back to where I am. So I usually have to like kind of sequester myself. And I was not able to do that. So I'm still working on the movie in a certain extent.
Yeah, and is that happening right after this festival?
Like, yeah, you know, yeah, right yeah. Just
great.
Just to make them full songs, you know.
I gotta get an album. I want a signed Boots Riley album.
Yeah, and then and Toon Yards came through too. I can't wait to hear. I want their score on vinyl because it's like all this Hawketing, like which you know, like you know what Hawketing is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So. And then just crazy instruments that they put in there. Right. Yeah.
Exciting. I'm sure I'm going to be the, I'm going to ask what everybody asks me, which is, you know, obviously I know exactly what's next for you, but what is next for Boots Riley? What is?
Well, obviously promoting this. Yeah. I spent so much time on it. I got to promote the hell out of this movie to make sure that it has the impact that it needs to have. But I got... You know, I went to film school 20-something years ago and dropped out because we got a record deal. But still, living 20 years as a disgruntled, failed film student, watching movies and feeling like, you know, there were things that I love and what I would do better and, like, kind of studying, like, what people do, what were people's processes. And, so along with that came like 20 years of ideas, like people are hitting me about doing other people's scripts or whatever and, you know, other things. And that's good for the money, but I'm like, fuck, I've been broke this long.
Yeah, I feel the same.
You know?
Yeah, you might as well.
Yeah, I might as well do the thing I want to do, you know?
Yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense.
And so I think, so that's... probably where it's going to be. There might be like something that, you know, I could do, like if I was going to collaborate with someone on some other idea that I didn't have, but I got lots of crazy ideas already. So, yeah.
It's great.
Before we go, what's next for you?
What's next for me is Boots Riley's Sorry to Bother You at 5:30 at Mark Theater. I know exactly where it's going to be, but I mean, like you said, I've been broke for so long and I owe so much to Sally Mae. And her and I have to sit down and have a real conversation about how how we're gonna tackle this.
Well, I'm sure you got
this loan.
I'm sure you got all kind of stuff. I mean, your brother does TV, right? And so he probably makes a good living doing that.
He does. You know, I think he wants to do film, you know, and the reality of like independent filmmaking, at least at that time, there wasn't as much TV, you know, and so to break in, it was like to get in, you have to get in. And now 7 years later, you know, so now he's like, okay, I think he wants to come back in, you know, and.
But so as far as money, is that an option for you?
I think, I mean, it's always an option. I mean, somebody came to me with, you know, season finale of Game of Thrones, like now we're talking, you know what I mean? But like, I'm in a slightly different situation where I've got, you know, I've got a son and a wife and I can't bounce around doing an episode here and an episode there. So I need to be a little bit more strategic in how I sort of map out a little bit of a longer game plan. So, I mean, if, you know, Cary Fukunaga did season 1 True Detective, like if something like that comes on my plate or I'm able to create it, like that's definitely more the path rather than like the one-offs here and there.
Yeah.
And I also feel like I could put a stamp on it. It could be something that's like, yeah. It's more about the vision than just like,
you know. It must be hard going into like doing one episode or something. Like what can you, you can't give the actors any different motivation than they already have.
Yeah, exactly. And the showrunners really run it. And
so it's like you're a babysitter or something?
A little bit. So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's a couple different ways to earn a living now, which is great. At least now there's I think Sundance is providing that a little bit of a platform for folks to say, hey, like we're out here, we're making stuff and pay attention. So meetings are coming that weren't happening before. So hopefully those meetings will materialize with like you said, I have a lot of years of ideas that I want to get off my chest. And I'm like, I'm going to just keep doing those until somebody comes to me with something that's like undeniable. Like, okay, you can't say no to this because this is like, you know, this is dope. You know, I'm doing James Bond with, you know, Idris. Like, I grew up watching that. Let's talk about that. Yeah. Let's talk about it. And until then, it's like, let me just make all this kind of crazy stuff that's in my head and original ideas and just, you know, keep the voice going.
Tight.
So, Boots, this was a pleasure.
Man.
And I can't wait to
talking to you.
Can't wait to see the film and support
you. We've
been
in the room, same room a lot, but never got to really have this conversation.
I will be championing the film after Sundance as well. So I'm just happy to support you in the process. Man,
as well, I'm really interested in seeing this movie. Hopefully, you'll be doing another screening somewhere soon that I can go check out.
Neon's going to put it out. So
when are they putting it out?
I think the plan is fall, but again, anything could happen. That gets shifted.
Oh, going for that Oscar. That
kind of, I don't know about, you know, listen, knock on wood, you know, we're just going for, listen, my mom ain't coming to Park City, you know, it's just the reality of that. Like she doesn't leave her hometown. So the fact that my mom will be able to get popcorn and soda and sit in a theater and watch it, whether it screens once or screens 10,000 times, like she's gonna have an opportunity to do that. And like, and she's, you know, she's a hard audience to reach, you know, so for her to be able to get that opportunity, hopefully other folks will come out and support. That's really what it comes out, supporting each other and hopefully the groundswell, grassroots, you know, that conversation.
Yeah. I do have one like interview-like question to ask you. Like, were there any scenes as far as getting them to work with the actors? Were there any scenes that, as you were shooting them, it took a while to get it to the place that you thought worked?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so the dinner scene in the film was what inspired the movie. It was a conversation I had with my cop friend. And always in the script, everybody that read the script, it was a problematic thing. They were like, oh, he's contradicting himself. You know, and it never really, I don't know if it was ever written to please people. So it was like people were having a weird reaction in the script when they were hearing it. I personally think it's one of the more powerful moments in the film. And I stuck to my guns with that. There were, you know, a lot of folks that were trying to get me to change that or to do stuff to make it, you know, I said, listen, I had the conversation. You can't, you know, I literally had the conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you can't tell me what that experience was like for me. Yeah. You know, like I'm not going to change. Like that is the essence of the movie was the awkwardness of this conversation. But I had never shot a scene with more than two characters before. So that was a four character scene. I had Nicole Beharie, who's an excellent actress, you know, Cassie Freeman and Don. And so it was just like, how do we orchestrate this really awkward thing? I had a conversation it was with one person. And so now we're fictionalizing it and making it, you know, a little bit more of like, you know, a couple's thing. And is it going to have the same, is it going to resonate the same, you know, as it did with me in that conversation. So that was, you know, the good thing is that we took it to the director's lab and we were able to workshop it. And I saw what John David did at the lab and was like, whoa, this guy, nobody really knows about him yet. You know, of course, if you watch Ballers, like he's the man on that show, but I hadn't even seen Ballers. So I don't have HBO. I'm a cord cutter. So, you know, I sign on for Game of Thrones and I sign off, you know, as soon as that show's done.
I miss when they used to have those tubes you could get from people on the street that would get you the free cable.
I know.
I think that's the reason why everybody has cable now is because the free cable people hooked it up and then they switched to digital and then everybody was hooked.
No, it's crazy. My dad used to get those boxes. I don't know where he got them from. $300 or whatever. You know, just get all those channels. And then they zap the box, you know, and you get just, you know, Z's. You have to get another box. But yeah, that was a challenge. That scene was a challenge, but it was more of a challenge to actually believe that I can pull it off because everybody was telling me to change it. And then when everybody's telling you to change it, you're like, man, maybe I should change it. You know, it's not just one person. We're talking like a few people that were like, it's not working.
And so what, so John David helped to...
He just helped to bring out the right tone of how to do it. You know, he just brought his own thing through the research of, he actually did a lot of ride-alongs with the Brooklyn police, did a lot of talking to them and offlining with the cops. So he like felt like he became an officer. You know, I think he truly believed it. And it's interesting. It'd be interesting to do something like this with him about his true experience. You know, obviously we got to chat a little bit, you know, on set, but then he had to go right back. You know, he was here for 2 days and he's back to Ballers. So, you know, to really talk about that experience for him, I think it was a really eye-opening experience. He was talking about, you know, seeing people bleed out and, you know, doing these, you know, ride-alongs. And he was like, yeah, so somebody getting shot in the neck and blood just, you know, just coming out of the neck, and like how calm these officers were, you know, how, you know, involved they were with the community relations. Now, he was with a specific unit within Bed-Stuy, which was primarily African-American police. So, you know, I don't know if that speaks to the whole force, but his experience felt like very true to his character, and I thought really helped to shape that scene. I would throw that back to you. Was there something in particular within your film that
you know what? With all the crazy stuff that's going on in the movie, and you know, which is very grounded by the performances of all these folks. The hardest scene was, and you haven't seen it yet. There's a bedroom scene after, it's hard to say it without spoiling it. But yeah, there's just a conversation that's between Lakeith's character, Cassius, and Tessa's character, Detroit, really trying to figure out what that was. That was like the thing we spit more takes on than anything, and just kind of playing with it and feeling it out. Yeah, that's with all the crazy stuff that's going on. That was the main performance that I felt we needed to mess with, and it may have been in the writing. And like some of my writing was while we were filming. People would say stuff, and I'd be like, "That sounds stupid. Did I write that?" You know, and then I'd be like, okay, try this, you know, or whatever. We try different things. Sometimes we do a silent take, like do the scene without any lines, or mix stuff up and do, you know. So there was a lot of playing around that had to do with that, maybe in everything that we shot, you know, and still kind of playing with that. But yeah, that scene, that one conversation between them two, kind of figuring out some things about themselves.
I got one more question for you. I think it's a brilliant title. I don't know anything about how you came to the title, but I'm so curious. I mean, I think it's just, I don't know. I could read so much into what it is, but it's just, it's catchy. It's, I don't know. It's just a great title. I'm just curious about
it's just what you say when you're a telemarketer. Often, you know, like, and you know what's funny is originally it sounded like, when I read it, it sounded kind of like a Judd Apatow film name. Sorry to bother you. Produced by Judd Apatow. And so I was like, there must be a hit name then.
That's you great. Know
even though the movie is nowhere near that aesthetic or anything like that, and it also could mean a few things. So on the title of the original album, you know, it was like, got all these things to say that might disrupt your, and that's kind of what the film is. It may disrupt your view of how the world works. And so, sorry to bother you.
That's great.
And thinking of that, that's something I should say now. Because we already did an album called Sorry to Bother You, the new soundtrack is called The Sun Exploding, and it relates to stuff that's talked about in the movie.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations to you, man. This is a beautiful thing.
All right. Thanks, man.
is a beautiful thing. You are a beautiful man. Sorry to bother you in theaters now. Go check it out.
Check it out. Also, make sure to check out Rinaldo Marcus Green's writing for the Talkhouse.
Yeah, he has a handful of written pieces. He was, of course, on our Oscar roundtable conversation a couple months ago. Before Monsters and Men comes out in October, you got to be up to speed on your Ray Green, man.
And don't forget that Toon Yards, a.k.a. Meryl Garbus, has joined us twice for conversations with Laurie Anderson.
Yeah, those episodes are awesome.
Powerful stuff that ended up seeing them collaborate.
We bring people together.
We do. We try. This week, listeners, we have a bumper 2 episodes for you. So you're hearing this on a Tuesday. On Thursday, Tim Kinsella, he of Joan of Arc, and Devendra Banhart have a project together covering each other's music that they'll be talking about right here on the Talkhouse podcast.
That's a pretty good episode, too.
Pretty good shit.
Yeah.
You can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are purveyed.
Yeah, that's a lot of places now.
You can catch behind-the-scenes pictures and quotes on Talkhouse's Twitter,
Instagram,
Facebook.
And, of course, just go check out all the awesome stuff that we have on the website. And while you're there, maybe, like, hit up YouTube as well. We got stuff there,
right? We've got full video episodes of the podcast there, Nick.
It's magical.
Magical.
What we do is magical. Thank you to Mark Yoshizumi, who co-produced this episode. And apologies for me for recording it in the way that I did. I did my best.
Nick, you did a hell of a job.
Thank you. Thank you.
If I don't see you before at the office, I'll see you for the footy.
Okay. Cup final!